ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jack Ashby is a British zoologist from Cambridge University's Zoological Museum, who writes very candidly, "If I sound excited about platypuses, it's because I am." Jack Ashby is fascinated by the utterly distinctive creatures that have evolved on our island continent. But nothing delights him as much as platypuses. And it is platypuses, by the way, not platypi, because it's a Greek word and not a Latin one. The British, when they first came to Australia, were confounded by the platypus, a creature that has a body like a mole, a bill like a duck, and feet like an otter, that lays eggs and yet suckles its young. Well, all that just threw out all their systems of animal classification out of whack. And the way they and the rest of the world dealt with their confusion was to all too often disparage Australia's wildlife as weird or even primitive. Australia was seen by them as a place with joke animals and, alarmingly, no pre-existing humans. Well, Jack Ashby doesn't think this is a very grown-up way to look at things. He sees platypuses and echidnas and Tasmanian devils and all our other creatures as noble, beautiful and fascinating. And he wants the world to know all about them. Jack's book is called Platypus Matters, The Extraordinary Story of Australian Mammals. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me today.
Your museum in Cambridge, this is Darwin's museum. What kind of stuff have you got in that museum?
We've got about 2 million specimens covering the whole of the animal kingdom, the whole of geological time, or biological time, I should say, the whole of the world. So, as you say, we've got a lot of Darwin specimens here. He was a student at Cambridge for a few years, and ended up leaving his collections to the Cambridge Philosophical Society, which is one of the founding parts of our museum.
So you got stuff there from the voyage of the Beagle. Have you got like a turtle or something, or a tortoise from the Beagle?
We have, and we've got what Darwin did when he came back from the Beagle is to partition off different groups of animals to different experts in those fields. And we ended up, or Cambridge ended up, with the fishes, which might not be the kind of the sexiest part of the Beagle collection. So we've got Darwin's fishes from the Beagle. We've also got the finches that came back from the Beagle, which are probably the most famous thing to come off the Beagle, because Darwin's finches, I'm doing air quotes around Darwin's finches here, are perhaps the best example of how evolution worked in Darwin's eyes. So these are the Galapagos finches. A finch, it turns out, or one species of finch, flew from South America to the Galapagos Islands and there evolved into 14 different species with different beaks. So some beaks for big nut-cracking beaks for smashing seeds, some really fine beaks for pecking flowers. And Darwin used this as an example of adaptive radiation, of to say this is how it evolved. But the reason I did air quotes is because our finches aren't actually collected by Darwin. They were collected by the captain Fitzroy and one of the crew, Fuller, who actually did a far better job than Darwin of labelling the specimens and where they came from.
So you're surrounded by all these wonderful specimens, and yet for you, it was the platypus that entirely enchanted you. Jack, tell me about this platypus. What was the first one you saw and how did you become so enchanted by it?
So the first platypus specimen I saw was actually in the museum in which I now work in Cambridge as an undergraduate many years ago. And our course in zoology was essentially you were given one group of animals per week and we'd have a load of lectures about that group and then we'd go to the museum for practical sessions with the specimens. And
so this was the week they wheeled out the monotremes, was
it? Absolutely. And my lecturer, Adrian Friday, who's still around the museum, kind of absolutely sparked this. These are the most amazing animals that have ever evolved, I thought for me. And they are absolutely astonishing. And then platypuses and echidnas acted as a kind of gateway drug for me into the rest of Australian mammals.
Why did you love them so much?
They are astonishing. The things they can do are kind of unlike pretty much any other mammal on Earth. And they're kind of an evolutionary biologist's dream because they've got features, you know, evolution works by starting at its starting point in whatever group you're looking at and then kind of adding or subtracting from there. And platypuses have retained some features that other mammals haven't retained, like walking with bent elbows and knees and laying eggs, obviously. But on top of that, have layered these absolutely astonishing adaptations that you don't see elsewhere.
You see, when I was talking about this with my producer Nicola earlier on, she and I both distinctly recall in school when we were kids being taught that monotremes were not mammals. Now, we both have memories of this in school, and we're going back some decades now, I'm afraid to say, Jack, in this case. And so it's interesting to hear you call them mammals. Has there been a shift or something?
Well, absolutely. This was a major conundrum when platypuses and echidnas were first encountered by Europeans in the 1790s. Because, so I'm pretty sure you weren't at school in the 1790s, but the rules by which naturalists had arranged the world didn't allow for platypuses and echidnas to be considered mammals. But it was really confusing because they had fur, which was a defining feature of mammals, remains a defining feature of mammals.
They suckle their young.
They suckle their young, but with platypuses and echidnas, because they don't have nipples, it took a really long time to prove that indeed they do produce milk.
Sorry, so, they suckle without nipples? That must hurt.
Well, I guess it hurts less because what they're doing is they're almost sweating their milk out.
So really? Have, right.
So the reason it was problematic is that female platypuses only, well, like anything, I guess, only have large mammary glands whilst they're actually lactating. So people kept catching platypuses that they couldn't find the mammary glands, they couldn't find the nipples, therefore not a mammal. But it turns out that they spread to cover pretty much the whole of their bellies and even up round on their backs.
Really?
Their milk glands. And then they sweat them out into these little milk patches on their undersides, and the babies lap them up from there. And actually, if you think about it, platypuses, I guess, are most famous for their bills, right? You can't suckle with a bill, so you can't attach yourself to a nipple with a bill. So if they did have nipples, they would never have evolved beaks, is my contention, I guess. There.
So how do they latch on?
All they're doing is basically kind of sucking it up from wicked fur.
Right.
So the milk goes into the fur, and they kind of lap it up from there.
So this is one of the reasons why they caused such confusion when the Europeans encountered them for the first time. They have fur like a mammal. They suckle their young like a mammal, even though they don't have nipples. But they lay eggs. So that's the thing, right?
That was the biggest controversy, that it took nearly 90 years to prove that platypuses and echidnas lay eggs.
What do you mean? So, how long did it take? What? Couldn't they just go and look at it?
I mean, first thing to say is, obviously, the first colonists were asking Indigenous Australians, how do they reproduce? And Indigenous Australians were saying, they lay eggs. And
they go, right, he's pulling my leg. Right.
They just didn't believe it. They just dismissed the people who have obviously known these species for 60,000 years or more.
So this is like a black swan event, in other words, isn't it? Or something like that, where you see, well, no one ever thought there could be a black swan until a black swan appeared.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so people were collecting platypuses and trying to stop. It was one of the biggest controversies of the 19th century, partly because it was so tied up with the idea of does evolution happen? You know, so Darwin's theory was published in 1859. So that 90-year fight for the platypus egg laying is right, kind of surrounds Darwin's publication. But I think there were people who just weren't willing to accept that something that looked like a mammal could do something so kind of primitive, if you like, and reptilian, dragging our noble class down into the mud with belly dragging frogs and lizards and things like that, and just in a kind of political social idea.
Because we're mammals, right?
Because we're mammals,
right?
But, and also that just the idea that if you've got a group that shows some kind of reptile-like characteristics and some mammal-like characteristics, so fur and eggs, for example, that would lend weight to the idea that species do change, that it's a kind of intermediate, which is not how we look at platypuses and echidnas now, but it's got features of both groups, which really adds weight to the evolution is true idea.
So in other words, they were confounding because they really taxed the European mind and all that kind of taxonomy they had of setting up this structure of how the animal kingdom was supposed to work. There's the platypus out there, and there's the echidna out there that says that, well, you're going to have to sort of dismantle that and put it back together again.
Exactly. They broke the rules.
They're rebels. They're evolutionary rebels. So when was it you first caught sight of a real-life platypus in the wild, Jack?
It was on the 23rd of December 2005. And I was in Tasmania, and we'd been... In fact, I was there, like, I don't know if I'm alone in this, but I hope a lot of kind of naturalists or nature loving people have these kind of I will use the word bucket list, but I think that may be dismissive a bit more. But like, there are species you want to see, and platypuses, since that undergraduate class, had been at the top of my list of I must see the species. And as soon as I got a job, that was the target. You know, save enough money to fly to Tasmania and see some platypuses. And we'd been there about a week or so, and we'd been doing the overland track, which is kind of a five, six day walk across central Tasmania in the middle of summer. And every night we'd go down to the lakes and rivers that we were camping by to look for platypuses. But unfortunately, it was beautiful weather and the overland track is beautiful, so many people were on it and they were all swimming. So we didn't have a chance. But on the very last night, which was Lake St. Clair, which is Australia's deepest lake, we'd come out of the snow. And so it's summer in Tasmania. I'm sure many people know that it can swing from t-shirt weather to snow. And we came out of the snow down through the rainforest, and it became really heavy rainforest rain. We thought, no one's going to be swimming tonight. So we went down to the lake and we sat there. And actually, my friend Toby Nodal and I had kind of got this scheme of you'd wait for someone to see a platypus, and then you'd wait for it to dive, and then you'd catch the attention of the other person.
What, you'd wave frantically?
You'd wave frantically, right. You'd shout. Right. Okay. Because platypuses close their eyes and ears underwater, so they can't hear anything. But right. They're super sensitive on the surface, so you have to kind of stand dead still. And Toby, I'd realised, had gone way out of earshot from where I was sitting. So I get up and I start following his footsteps. And I can see him on the other side of this marsh. And in his face, it is obvious to me that he has just seen a platypus. And I am terrified because what the worst case scenario is that he sees it and I don't.
And you haven't, right.
I'm so selfish. But
flown all the way to Tassie, haven't you? Yes.
Yeah. So he signals that it's safe to come, that it's diving. And we kind of stand there. So this, I think the tried and tested rules of seeing a platypus are like, I don't know if you have this game in Australia, but grandmother's footsteps or what's the time, Mr. Wolf, of where...
Monsters in the dark.
Monsters in the dark. Is that it? So
yeah.
You've got to creep closer to your target, but if they see you move, you're out. And that's how it goes with the platypus. So you wait for them to dive, and you give yourself 30 seconds.
Exactly. 30 seconds.
And you freeze and you wait for it to come back up again. And on that time, we'd seen it. It was just kind of overjoyed. And we crept closer, I think, three times of this kind of dive, run, freeze, surface, dive, run, freeze. And the third time, it dived and I ran and up to my closest point. And I was, I gave myself my 30 seconds and then platypus did not reappear, and maybe 2-3 minutes later, and they can do amazing things. They can drop their kind of metabolism to like 10 beats per minute. Their hearts can go to by
so they
diving,
can stay then down stay there for a while, right?
10 minutes or more.
10 minutes without breathing, right?
Yeah, and eventually when it surfaced, it's like I got the rules wrong, and I just ran. It was like I'd been waiting too long, and it dived, and it was gone.
But you glimpsed it then.
We got more than a glimpse. We saw it for a good three surfaces, which is great.
I get a sense of, I don't know, am I overstating this? But a sense of your sense of sacredness. Did you feel like you were kind of a guest in some amazing space, like a natural cathedral or something like that?
I think so. I think it's always the case when you're kind of encountering live wild mammals. You know, I work with dead specimens in museums where it's very much on our terms. We can do whatever we like. You know, we can turn them whatever angle.
Which is boring. Yeah.
Which it's not boring. You learn so much from these specimens, but in the wild, you're there on the animal's terms. There's nothing you can do to make them stay longer.
Yes, you're a grown man playing Monsters in the Dark.
Exactly.
With the platypus, it has this famous bill that's often likened to the bill of a duck. Is it like the bill of a duck?
It is not. So I think when, the species was described by Europeans in Europe, so they were sent dried specimens. So once you're sent, it's they go leathery. In fact, if you look at historic images of platypuses, where the bill joins the face, the bits that's supposed to cover the face, so the back of the bill folds over their face, it's kind of stuck upright, and it's kind of at right angles to their bill. You see this on historic drawings and then taxidermy which have been copied from historic drawings, but actually it's soft and supple and leathery in life.
Oh, it's not like a beak then?
No, so it's got two little rods of bone running through it. I think they look like an earwig's pincers. as a skeleton, but then they're covered with this skin, and it's soft and leathery. But inside is the most astonishing sensory system of any mammal.
What do you mean?
They are platypuses and echidnas, and one species of dolphin are the only mammals that can detect electricity. So their bills have electroreceptors in them. And the reason for that is, as I said, they close their eyes and ears underwater, but they can eat 700 grams a day of crayfish and worms.
Wow.
So it's a lot of worms. So how do they find this food? And the answer is electroreception. So as we're taught in biology classes at school, every muscular contraction, including our heartbeats, is controlled by an electrical impulse from our nervous system. And platypuses can sense the world in these electrical impulses. So they're basically hunting their worm and crayfish prey down by feeling their heartbeats, the electrical impulses given off by their heartbeats.
So that's why they rummage around in the gravel of the riverbed with their bills?
Yes, exactly. So they kind of work like a metal detectorist, sweeping their bills around. If you watch them, it's very back and forth. They're also very, very sensitive to touch, so they can feel things too. They don't need to use electricity all the time.
So once they've caught the prey in their bill, how do they actually grind it up?
So this is a great story, I think. Firstly, they have pouches like a hamster. So they, whilst they're underwater, they stuff all their food into their cheek pouches. And then once they only eat on the surface. And as I'm sure anyone who's been to the dentist knows, teeth are a really bad idea. You know, like, sure, they can grind things up, but if they get damaged, it's game over.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, it's extremely unpleasant. And platypuses eat really hard food, so they smash, you know, many, many crayfishes a day. But what they've done is they've evolved from animals with teeth. And in fact, platypuses grow tiny little teeth and then reabsorb them. So they definitely evolved from animals with teeth. But what they've done is they're adults as don't have teeth. They've evolved these horny ridges. They look like a kind of comb on its side. And they're made of horns, they're made of keratin, so the same as our fingernails and our hair. And these are constantly regrowing ridges. So they're really tough. They can grind up crayfish and mollusks and whatever else they might eat, and just constantly regrow. So it's a fantastic evolutionary adaptation.
So what they sit in the side of their mouths?
They're where their teeth would be.
Where their teeth would be. And
in
they're like these regrowing plates then, are they?
Yeah.
That can crush crayfish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And they're really bumpy. They look, like I say, look like a comb.
Well, if this is such a good thing, why don't we have these
That's
things?
A great question. You
we
know,
don't know.
I think it's so weird that so few
the conspiracy
mammals.
Conspiracy of dentists are keeping the whole teeth thing going, perhaps?
Only one mammal, as far as we know, has evolved ever replacing teeth, and actually that's a species of wallaby.
How versatile are those webbed little hands and feet that they've got?
Super versatile. So they live in three worlds. They live underground as burrowing mammals, they live on land as walking mammals, and they live in the water as swimming mammals. And they do that because of their front feet. And I like to describe them as kind of transformers or Swiss Army knives, that they pop out these tools or fold them away depending on what they're doing. So in the water, they can fold out this big fan of skin that goes beyond their fingers, and kind of held by the struts of their fingernails, their claws. And that makes, you know, a great paddle, so they're very good swimmers.
Yeah, but what about when they're on land, though?
On land, they fold up this webbing and walk on their knuckles. So they kind of bunch up fists and they walk like that. And then when they're digging, they fold out like a garden fork. So they fold back the webbing, but their claws are really long for an animal of their size. And they can, you know, female platypus can dig over 10 metres.
So they're also, you know, encased in this beautiful, thick, silky-looking fur. How good is that at keeping water from their skin?
It's amazing, because if you watch a platypus for any length of time, after a little while it'll start preening itself. So they'll start grooming, and they're super flexible. Their hind feet can kind of reach under their, you know, over their heads. And that's because...
What? Really?
Yeah, some of the most flexible animals I've ever seen. And that's because, you know, all aquatic mammals tend to have really, with fur, should I say semi-aquatic mammals, tend to have really dense underfur, because it's strange to think of, but a platypus can spend 20-odd hours underwater without getting wet. So their fur is so dense in a healthy platypus that underfur will keep them dry. And unfortunately for them, that became a major target of the kind of fur industry. They are the animals with... you know, in the 19th century at least, with the most valuable fur of any Australian mammal.
This is an odd question, but do they make noises? I don't think I've ever heard or seen in a video, or certainly not live, a platypus make any noises. But do they make any noises?
The young ones have been described as growling in their nests, which I find quite adorable.
You've not heard this yourself?
I've not heard this myself, but people who have excavated them get these, have just described like this kind of little puppy-like growl, which is it's quite adorable.
Like a little, that sort of thing.
I think so.
You mentioned there that they burrow. How do they make these burrows, and where do they do that?
So again, they do. I think they burrow better than any other burrowing animal I can think of. If you ever watch most burrowing animals, what they're doing is kicking out fur behind soil behind them. So they kind of excavate a bit and they'll push the fur, the soil backwards, and then you'll see these big spoil heaps of soil outside their burrows, which makes them
easy to find.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And plus, if you kind of watch marmots, which are kind of like the European version of a wombat, and they just seeing showers right. of soil flying out the ground behind them. But what platypuses do is they, at least where the soil's soft enough, is that they kind of just push the soil into the walls. So they make no spoil heaps, which means they're really hard to find. They're really strong. If you look at a platypus skeleton, it's covered with these lumps and bumps that attach muscle for making really, really big spade-like hands when they're in that configuration.
So and where do they put the spoil, though? Where do they put the soil?
They just push it into the walls of the tunnel. So they
wiggle in, and
so the platypus burrow is pretty much the same dimension as a platypus. They all kind of spin round to tamp the soil into the walls. It also means that if you're a 30, 40 centimetre long animal that's burrowing for 10 metres, you don't have to move 10 metres of soil, which is really energetically costly, back down the burrow to get it out of the hole. You just push it into the walls.
So they're making the walls of their burrows out of what is tightly compressed soil then. So that makes it structurally stronger
really
too,
strong,
I suppose.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. Why is Australia so special to you, aside from the platypus? And how does the wildlife in Australia compare to other continents you visited, Jack?
Well, it's not a very scientific thing to say, but I think they are the best animals living in Australia.
I appreciate the fact you're subjective in such matters. I think this is good.
Yeah. I guess the scientific reason is that Australia and New Guinea are the only place in the world where all three groups of mammals exist. So mammal class is split into three groups. Placental mammals like us, which produce babies after a long pregnancy that then finish off their infant growth by a short period of suckling milk. And then there are marsupials, which do the opposite. So they have a really short pregnancy and then do most of their infant growth suckling milk, often in a pouch. And then there are platypuses and echidnas, which lay eggs. And New Guinea and Australia are the only place where you can find all three. So it's kind of a mammal-watching dream here.
You nonetheless have seen some pretty extraordinary creatures in other parts of the world. You've seen like a sloth bear, is that right? Or have I got that wrong? Sorry, a bear, sloth, or...
A sloth bear, yeah.
A sloth bear, right.
I have, but it's one of the most frustrating encounters I've ever experienced because all I could see was it's the pinpricks of its eyes. We could hear it feeding on fruit. We hear it snuffling around. And in the very, very limits of our torch beam, we just got this reflection back of eyes and we were whisked away by our guide.
Why is that?
Because they are probably one of the most dangerous mammals on Earth. Their claws are maybe 10 centimetres long for smashing into anthills and termite mounds. And they are very vicious. And so when we're walking around at night, stumble across a feeding sloth bear.
But they're so adorable. They're really cute, those bears.
That's what Baloo from the Jungle Book is based on, sloth bear. So, yeah,
and
what,
they'll just eviscerate you, will they?
Yeah, they'll just take your face off.
How about seeing snow leopards? You've seen snow leopards in the wild, which is an incredible privilege. Like, I had the snow leopard expert on some years ago. I think it took years before he'd seen one. How did you get to see one?
Snow leopards had been, after platypuses and echidnas and wombats had kind of, I'd managed to see them and see them regularly. Snow leopards were at the top of the list, but never realistically thought it was possible. But then one day, my friend again, Toby Nolan, who works as a natural history filmmaker, he said, "I've got it. I've got the place, and I've got the hookup where we can go, which is Spiti Valley in India. Most people go to Leh in Ladakh, and we went a bit further south, and it was fraught." With the typical adventure of kind of remote parts of the world, where we got there and an avalanche knocked out the road, and we were stuck in this tiny village behind the, you know, the wrong side of the avalanche for the snow leopards for 3 days. And eventually someone said, okay, we're driving to the avalanche. Someone's driving on the other side, climb over the avalanche and we'll swap cars. And then we drove back up the mountain and we saw snow leopards every day. Every day for a week or so. It was absolutely stunning. You're like looking into the eyes of a snow leopard.
But they saw you as well.
They saw us. I admit we were separated by a narrow gorge, but there was a mother and two cubs, just old enough. They were just about to leave her, and there was a male prowling around waiting to mate, I think, as soon as the females had got rid of the young. And it was it's one of those things you just can't believe that you are there with one of the most hard to see animals on earth.
They're so beautiful, aren't they? They are so incredibly beautiful. What's it like to watch them move with that authority and confidence?
Yes, exactly that authority. They're slinking. They kind of walk through snow with such ease. Their feet are huge as kind of snowshoes. And then watching them kind of climb among the rocks in hunt of ibex and blue sheep. It's just, it kind of makes your hair stand on end.
A large part of your book, Jack, is the strange things that happened when Europeans spotted the platypus for the first time, when they first came to Australia, and how much chaos and confusion it caused in the scientific world and in the larger world in general, just by the very existence of an animal like the platypus, which suckles its young and yet lays eggs and seems to be, to a European's eyes, an amalgam of a whole bunch of other animals. Now, you've got a picture in your book that comes from the second governor of New South Wales, John Hunter. It's a picture of a platypus. Tell me the story of how he came to make that drawing and what became of that platypus that he drew.
Yeah, so Hunter was out on the Hawkesbury River near Sydney, and he was watching a Darug man hunting on the water, and he watched him spear this animal, which Hunter then went on to describe as an amphibious animal of the mole kind, which I love. I love that the earliest English name for platypuses was duck mole, which I think
duck mole,
I think is kind of perfect. But then first to say that, so Hunter is kind of given credit for discovering the platypus and for collecting this platypus, ignoring the fact that it was, of course, a Darug man
who speared it and found it and put it in front of him, yes.
Exactly. And so then Hunter ships it off in a barrel firstly to Joseph Banks, whose name is written all over the natural history of Australia in the last 250 years, and then asking him to take it to the Royal Literary and Philosophical Society in Newcastle upon Tyne, which is a town in the northeast of England. And in its barrel, so it was in a barrel of spirits, was a wombat that Hunter had also tried to keep alive, and it died after 6 weeks because Hunter failed to work out what it ate, which I find quite surprising because, you know, wombats eat grass and sedges and other things like that. But then it arrived in Newcastle and it was carried to the docks.
Like a pickled wombat and a pickled platypus in the same barrel?
The same barrel, right. Yeah. Complete, except for their guts that he'd sent them over. And he's, unfortunately, the story goes that there's a woman whose name has not been recorded carrying the barrel on her head to the society's meeting rooms. And as she entered the building, it smashed and she was drenched in pungent spirits. One of the first Europeans ever to touch a platypus as it whacked her on the head on the way down. And a 30-kilo wombat, which is presumably slightly more dangerous.
So this poor woman was suddenly drenched and draped in alcohol and pickled platypus and wombat remains?
Exactly, yeah.
That'd be a really stupid way to die, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
It'd be an amusing obituary, but yeah. But she did survive this
week. She survived.
Yeah,
as far as it's recorded.
And then she was unhappy, though. I think we can sort of guess that.
I imagine so, But let's hope amongst that unhappiness was just the joy of, oh my goodness, look at this amazing animal. But yes, along with those specimens, Hunter had sent drawings of his duck mole and of the wombat too. So that's kind of how Europe came to know of the species.
You've got a story too that sort of continues this story of Europe's strange relationship with the platypus. Winston Churchill wanted to get hold of some platypuses during World War II. What's the story behind that?
It is bizarre to think that whilst, you know, running the Western sphere of World War II, it's like, oh, do you know what would really help me right now? It's six live platypuses.
Well, he was an animal lover. I think he had a pet goat for a while. He had cats and dogs around Chartwell. He also took care to make sure there were ravens in the Tower of London during the war, and that the monkeys were in Gibraltar as well. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was decided that, yes, it would probably be politically sensible for Australia to go against its legislation against exporting platypuses and send Winston Churchill one platypus.
Why did he want a platypus though?
It's unclear. He just really, liked the idea of having a platypus. Platypuses are ridiculously hard to keep in captivity. But the one man who had successfully bred them in captivity was David Flay. And so he was put in charge of preparing this platypus, who was also to be called Winston, for his voyage to the UK. And
what became of the poor thing?
Well, unfortunately, just 4 days out of Liverpool docks, the ship was torpedoed by German U-boats. And although the ship didn't sink, the kind of shockwaves, I guess, to such a sensitive animal, especially after a long voyage where its worm rations had been reduced, it died. So I think it's kind of extraordinary that a platypus was a victim of World War II bombing.
A World War II attack. Do we know where this platypus is now?
We don't. We know that the story of the import and export of the platypus was kept from the British public because the failure isn't good propaganda.
Right.
Churchill then kept the taxidermied animal on his desk, but its whereabouts are currently unknown.
We talked a little bit about the fact that platypuses suckle the young, but they don't have nipples and they have these strange, enormously large mammary glands that sort of seem to encircle their bodies, I think you were saying. Tell me about the whole process of platypus courtship, if you can. How does the course of platypus love run between a lady and a man, platypus who are loving each other very much?
It's hard to observe this in the wild because they are tricky species to study. But what's been seen in captivity is it's very much up to the female platypus that whenever, you know, the male comes knocking, if she's not keen, she'll just swim off to another area. But when she is ready, they engage in this beautiful aquatic dance where they follow each other around and they bite on. Like he'll bite onto her tail and vice versa, and they'll swim round in these platypus love circles and kind of go upside down and tumble through the water. And then when the moment comes, he'll bite onto her neck or onto her back and pop his penis out of his cloaca, which is...
Out of his cloaca?
Yep, so monotremes have cloacas, which is a kind of one-stop shop for all of their reproduction and waste disposal needs.
It's all the one thing, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. So they don't have separate holes. They just have the one hole. But the penis is only popped out when it's needed. They don't even... They don't pee through their penises, which is unusual.
Wow, right.
He'll kind of fold his back end of his body under hers and... they'll mate, and then he'll swim off into the sunset, never to be seen again.
Really?
And
he's a deadbeat.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Deadbeat dad. And so once she's impregnated, then she digs a burrow. Then does she?
Digs a burrow. Digs a nesting burrow, which is long, maybe 10 meters long, with a chamber at the end, and that she'll keep that moist with some vegetation. Lay her eggs after it's either 3 weeks of gestation and then 10 days of incubation, all the other way around. I think it's that way around.
And these eggs, are they like I don't know, chicken eggs or ostrich eggs?
They're most like snake and crocodile eggs. So they're a bit flexible, turtle eggs. So they're kind of marble. They're a bit like an elongated marble. They're just, you know, 1.5 centimetres or so long and a little bit shorter, a little bit less fat than that. And she'll lay 2 or 3 of them, mostly 2. And they stick together, which is quite unusual. So they're covered in some kind of secretion that means that they stick together, and I think perhaps that makes them easier to keep hold of. And she'll keep them clamped in her fold up, like against her belly, by folding her tail up over them, which is kind of sweet. And then
I'm going to ask you a very unscientific question here, but do you are prepared to sort of be a bit subjective about things. Are their babies adorable?
They're so adorable. There isn't really a word for them. So I've proposed platypups. So I'd like people to go out in the world and you know, call baby platypuses platypups. But they hatch with a kind of like comedy human nose. And that's because they've got this little lump called a caruncle, which they use firstly to break out of the shell. They also have an egg tooth. And then the caruncle is also used for, you know, kneading the mother's mammary glands, to promote milk production. And then the bills kind of grow into a more platypus shape over months, but they are very sweet.
Something else I didn't know until I read your book is that the male platypus has venom. A mammal with venom? Is that as unusual as I think it is, Jack?
Well, the list of venomous mammals is extremely short. So there's platypuses, there's shrews, there's slow lorises, and there's selenodons, which are related to shrews.
Slow lorises are venomous?
Yeah,
they are. This is where you can get away from them. Pretty sharpish, isn't it?
Absolutely. But yeah, platypuses, male platypuses.
Look out! Here comes the slow loris. But where does the male platypus keep this venom? In its mouth or teeth? Oh,
no teeth.
Of course, yeah. Right. So where does it keep it?
They have long spurs, about 2 centimetres long, on the inside of their ankles. And in fact, they're the only known seasonally venomous animal across the animal kingdom. So the only animal that is only venomous some of the time.
Well, what does that tell you, that it's seasonally venomous?
That they use their venom for competition in mating. So it's male-on-male competition, so they're fighting each other and envenomating each other, because if it were used for defence, we'd expect the females to be venomous too, but they are not.
Is there research being done with this venom? A medical research being done with platypus venom? That's such an odd thing to say.
It's extraordinary. The venom is, I was about to say, the venom is unlike any other venom on Earth, but that's the opposite is true. The cocktail is unlike anything else on Earth, but actually they've evolved venom that is almost, so they've got maybe 20 or so different venom compounds. But each of those compounds have evolved convergently with the venom that's seen in centipedes, frogs, fishes, snakes, spiders, jellyfish. So they've kind of got the best bits of venom from the animal kingdom. And of course, this isn't how evolution works. They've taken them together and made a super cocktail. And it's not many people have recorded being stung by a platypus. But
yeah, I was going to say, I've lived in Australia for some time and I don't know anyone who's ever been, got stung by a bloody platypus the other day.
Those that have done have described an excruciating pain that can last for months, literally months. And then, muscle wastage that goes on for decades. So people have been unable to regain movement for, you know, I think one report I can think of that I can specify a natural number was 15 years. Still couldn't move their hands properly. And that is because one of these compounds is extraordinarily stable. So it just doesn't break down. And that may be why platypus venom lasts so long. So yes, in answer to your question, those compounds could be potentially very useful for kind of pain reduction and just how do pain receptors work in humans.
The other great monotreme in Australia is the echidna. It's a very different looking beast to the platypus, is it? It also, you know, lays eggs and suckles its young. Like I say, they seem to be really different creatures, the spiny anteater and the platypus. Are they more closely related than they appear to be, Jack?
Yeah, so it happened a while ago. It probably happened about 50 million years ago, but echidnas evolved from a platypus ancestor. The oldest fossil we have, I think, is only 15 million years, but genetics suggest 50 million. Once you take their clothes off, their skeletons are quite similar. Echidnas are a brilliant animal too. These spines, they are such a good defensive system. If they can move them individually, they can lock them into kind of roots and soil and pebbles, so they become immovable. But my favourite thing about echidnas is what they do with their hands. And if you've ever encountered an echidna, you walk up to it and it very quickly rolls up into a ball and tucks its head and its legs, the most vulnerable parts, tucks its legs and its head under the spine. I call that DEFCON 2. But if they're really scared, What they do is use all four hands, and they do jazz hands with all four feet, should I say, and it drills like kind of like a handheld blender. It drills vertically into the soil, and you just watch them with nothing more than a shimmy. They just disappear downwards into the soil, and those feet then lock into roots and pebbles too, and they become completely immovable. You cannot pick up a platypus that's gone to DEFCON 1. An echidna, should I say.
You went out to Bruny Island, Tassie, with a friend of yours to go looking for echidnas. Tell me about that experience for you, the adventure you had at Adventure Bay
Bay. And so we'd seen echidnas were actually first encountered by Europeans in Adventure Bay in 1792, which is a nice circle to that story. But yes, I think the story you're talking about is we've been in there, we've been looking at echidnas and quolls and the other wonders of Bruny Island, and we'd been staying in our car in the car park. We'd been sleeping in the car in the beach car park in Adventure Bay, as you know, poor young people do, rather than pay to go in the campground. And every day we'd wake up with a flat battery. I won't go into what was happening there, but every day we'd go into the Adventure Bay General Store, and they would lend us. They refused to sell them to us, but they'd lend us jump leads, and we'd have to jump start the car. So we became very well known to the general store, and they convinced us to go to the Adventure Bay New Year's Eve party. You know, they said, oh, you know, bring your own food, bring your own music, bring your own grog. And we expected that everyone in South Bruny, or at least 150 people or so in reach of the village, would be there. But we opened the door. It was a stormy night. It felt like, I don't know if American Werewolf in London. And you go, the tourists open the door to the pub, and everyone just stops immediately and stares at them. And there were 12 people in this party. And they were extraordinarily welcoming, but they were all waltzing. So they'd been learning a waltz for the New Year's Eve party since February. But one of the guests, so there's 12 people, and there was a wallaby, which was an extraordinary experience that someone had rescued a pouch young of a roadkill Bennett's wallaby. So I spent much of the evening with this baby wallaby that couldn't leave the warmth of a warm body. So it was definitely the best New Year's Eve I've ever had.
A large part of your book is about this odd disdain there is for Australia's wildlife. It's historic, really. You hear it from Americans, you hear it from the British, you hear it from Europeans as well, where Australia's wildlife is seen as kind of primitive. It's a really odd thing. It's a really kind of an odd, irritating thing I find every time I've gone to America. Americans will say, oh, I can't possibly go to Australia. I'll get killed in 5 seconds. Everything in Australia is trying to kill you. What do you make of all that, this culture of Australia is like the junkyard of God's mistakes, you know?
So I think, absolutely. I think those two things you just described, the kind of everything is trying to kill you and the primitive idea, are both very much intertwined. So that these are both ways of kind of writing off Australian mammals and I'm sure entirely subconscious, but it's a hangover from a colonial mindset. If you read any 19th century description or 18th century description of Australian mammals, they are all, without exception, describing them as lesser mammals, of lower, inferior, primitive, indeed, that they are not meeting this. So in being seen as being different to the kind of zoological standard of the animals they were familiar with in Europe and the Americas.
What, they're letting down the side or something, the mammals, our own.
They're using this zoological standard, and simply by being different to a placental mammal, like a cow or a human, they were just written off as being inferior to it. And I think it very much was tied into the kind of colonial project of kind of putting down everything in Australia, the people, the landscape and habitats and climate and the wildlife. And by tying the wildlife into this kind of terra nullius argument that there is nothing there of value, it helped justify the invasion. And as I say, every single scientific description is saying these are strange, weird, primitive, inferior animals. And where that the kind of everything is trying to kill you comes in, I think it's absolutely bonkers, you know.
Like, yeah, America, like I always say to Americans, you've got bears in your country, man. They're like sharks that can walk on land.
Exactly.
And they come into your backyard and eat your trash. I mean, no sharks. It's like, are you crazy? It's like, it's really weird.
Yeah, other than Europe, or at least parts of Europe, that Australia is the only continent that doesn't have any large land predators. So it is the safest place. I've spent the last couple of weeks in Tasmania on fieldwork, and I'd be out every night on my own in the forest, spotlighting for animals with absolutely no fear that I'm going to get eaten by a tiger or a bear or a wolf at any point.
Your toe won't get nibbled off by a Tasmanian devil?
Well, it's pretty unlikely, unfortunately.
But it's interesting when you look back at the first responses the British had when they came to Australia, to the natural world of Australia. They were often arriving in places as beautiful as Sydney Harbour, the Derwent River, the Swan River. And you can see in some of the records, sometimes they went, oh, this is an incredibly beautiful place. This is stunning. But then there are others like Baron Field, who wrote this poem called Kangaroo. I'm just going to quote the first stanza of it for you. It might be the only stanza, actually. He came here in 1816 to serve as a judge. He wrote, "Kangaroo, kangaroo, thou spirit of Australia that redeems from utter failure, from perfect desolation, and warrants the creation of this fifth part of the earth, which would seem an afterbirth, not conceived in the beginning, for God blessed his work at first, and saw that it was good, but emerged at the first sinning, when the ground was therefore cursed, and hence this barren wood." Imagine arriving in Australia and just going, well, this is God's junkyard like this. It's an extraordinary thing. This is really a widespread phenomenon, you found.
It is, absolutely, throughout the 19th century and 20th century. But actually, I think it harks on today, in that if you go to any museum, hopefully outside of Australia, you go to any museum, or read any newspaper article about Australian mammals, particularly platypuses, or go to, watch a TV documentary, the trope is, these are strange animals. They are weird and wonderful, but nonetheless weird. And no other continent, another large part of the world, has its wildlife treated in this way. And every animal is weird. Like deer, how strange is it that an animal grows 30 kilos of bone every year and then just drops
out of its head?
Out of its head. And just, but like, no one thinks, oh, the deers are weird. You know, if you go to, you know, where, you know, India or Africa, places with, you know, massive hunting hunting as well, but safari industries, those animals are considered kind of noble and majestic. Elephants and rhinos and tigers and lions, like majestic and awesome is the words you get for those. You don't, no one describes, except, you know, fans like ourselves, I hope, wombats as kind of majestic. And I think this is all tied into the way we've been socially conditioned by these years of kind of colonial, nitpicking, well, not nitpicking, but, you know, denigration of saying that they are kind of inferior, strange beasts.
Yes, Australia, all very nice, but it's not Kew Gardens, is it? That attitude as well. The word primitive is interesting. Does that mean anything to you as a naturalist, as a zoologist? What does primitive mean?
It is so regularly used that, you know, people would say platypuses and echidnas are the world's most primitive mammals. But that makes absolutely no scientific sense. Let aside the kind of unscientific fact that I think they are the best animals. Every animal on Earth is equally evolved, living animal. Every animal is equally evolved. What it comes from is that, as I said earlier, they've retained certain features that we might consider primitive. So in the evolutionary biology, we might call a feature primitive. So egg laying is a primitive feature because it's inherited from monotremes, reptile-like ancestors. But that doesn't make the whole species primitive. We all have primitive features. Legs, human legs, are primitive features because we've evolved them from first fishes to walk on land. But that doesn't make us primitive. It's entirely subjective what we choose to say, this what set you apart. You know, and interestingly, with eggs in platypuses, that's considered primitive. But if you look at eggs in birds, birds also evolved, retained eggs from their reptile-like ancestors, the dinosaurs.
Yeah, and you could turn it around, like you say, and say that the platypus has these advanced grinding mechanisms to grind down their food. They have these advanced forms of very stable compounds in their venom. But it's not like there are platypus scientists in laboratories working on this all the time, is there? So it's a kind of an odd thing to say primitive or advanced. None of this makes sense. What about intelligence? Sometimes they're regarded as, Australian animals are often dismissed as unintelligent. Is that weird too?
It's also strange. And that goes back to, again, 19th century descriptions who just write them off as animals with small brains and low intelligence. And the small-brained idea, particularly for marsupials, was considered so pervasive that no one bothered to check. until it was 2010. My colleagues Anjali Goswami and Vera Weisbecker thought, hang on, let's actually see how big Australian mammals' brains are. And they measured the brain capacities of a load of different mammals from across the world. And they found that if you took out one group of animals, which have freakishly large brains, which are the primates, if you take primates out of the equation, marsupials and placental mammals have the same size brains compared to their body mass. And in fact, at small body sizes, marsupials have bigger brains. So it's a complete nonsense to suggest that they're unintelligent. But again, you watch TV shows, and you watch a wombat on a TV show, on a documentary, you can guarantee that they'll have some kind of bumbling background music that kind of just suggests that they're a bit stupid.
Yeah, and koalas are dopey too. Yeah. That's the other thing as well. So this is all part of a colonial mindset to your mind.
I think so. It's a subconscious hangover from the way we've been conditioned by two centuries or more of Australian zoology.
And is the platypus suffering from this, do you think?
Well, unfortunately, it's not just the platypus, but Australia has the worst mammal extinction rate of anywhere in the world, of every, from across the world, of all extinctions that have happened since 1788, more than a third have happened in Australia. And I think it just can't help if we write these animals off as inferior. It doesn't help, you know, argue against, you know, other demands on Australian resources if you're going up against, you know, mining or land clearing, or urbanisation, to think, oh, these little animals, they're cute, but ultimately they're, you know, evolutionary destined to go extinct. That's not how evolution works, and I don't think it helps their case. I think we should embrace the wonderful and get rid of the weird and wonderful.
Embrace the platypus. That's the message here today. Well, but not literally, because they have venomous spurs. Jack, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Jack Ashby is the Assistant Director of the Museum of Zoology at the University of Cambridge, and his book is called Platypus Matters, The Extraordinary Story of Australian Mammals. This program was made on the lands of the Gadigal peoples. The producer was Mickey Morris. The executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.